Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests tonight are Paul Jenkins, who's the editor of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Brendan Joel Kelly of the Anchorage Press, and by phone in Fairbanks, Dermot Cole, columnist for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. This is Anchorage Edition, so let's start with Anchorage and take a look at the local elections that happened earlier this week. Paul, give us the overview of the Anchorage municipal election.
Well, I think you could categorize this one as, what if they had an election and nobody showed up? There's 201,000 registered voters in the city, and most of them stayed home. It was a pretty straightforward election with nothing sexy on the ballot. We had five assembly seats up, and we had five propositions. One proposition failed, the bus bonds again. And other than that, it was pretty straightforward. There's a lot of reasons, I suppose, for poor turnout in municipal elections, one of them being they're in April. Maybe one day we'll get smart and move it back where it belongs, to the November general election. But until then, I think we can have lousy turnouts until we put things like, you know, gay transit bonds on. Then we'll have people turn out by the millions, and it'll be a good election. But nothing sexy, nothing exciting. People stayed home.
Okay, Brendan, your assessment, and what is the latest on the Trainee Clary race in Midtown for the Assembly?
Starting with that, the latest, there was an issue in Fairview with the wrong ballots being given out, Midtown ballots being given to downtown voters. Downtown didn't have an assembly member up for grabs. They only have one, Patrick Flynn, and he's not up till next year, I believe. So some Midtown ballots were handed out to people who shouldn't have voted on them, 175 total. Before that, Dick Traney was leading Andy Clary, the young conservatives, Sullivan and Dorsey, by 183 votes. After they removed those 175 ballots, the lead is down to 147 votes. But there's still an unknown amount of absentee ballots out and some 1,480 questioned ballots that will be all tallied up by the 16th. So 147 votes, not a big margin. Clary could climb back. Traney, known quantity. You know, he was a Midtown Assemblyman for 10 and a half years. Overall assessment, it seems that the middle of the road won, you know, at least two of the three candidates in the contested races. The Eagle River and South Anchorage weren't really contested. The incumbents had an easy go, Jennifer Johnston.
Did it surprise you that that Matt Klayman lost so decisively to Ernie Hall in that West Anchorage district?
No, you know, after the whole acting mayor thing, when Matt was chair and knew he was going to run for mayor and didn't step down as chair as some of his assembly mates had expected him to do, when Mark Begich won the senatorial election and Matt became acting mayor, I think he lost some of his allies, say he went on the assembly, and Ernie Hall, you know, ran as a Democrat with Fran Ulmer for lieutenant governor,
right,
but had
right.
the support of Mayor Sullivan. Eric Croft, Mayor Sullivan's opponent in the runoff, showed up in an ad with the mayor endorsing him. He had union support as well as the mayor's support. So he really had a real broad base of support. And then
he's well known and well liked on top of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Executive director for Rondi, you know, he's one of the good guys. And then Lieutenant Paul Honeman beat Adam Trombley, another young Sullivan endorsee conservative. Honeman swears he's never been a member of a party, absolutely nonpartisan. And then Mr. Traney, supposing he does win, I have a friend who's a political consultant that calls him Dick Windsock Traney. This time around, although he faced L.V. Gray Jackson in the last election, L.V. Gray Jackson endorsed him in this election. So this time around, Traney had the support of the quote-unquote progressives. How will he vote? There's no telling, really. I mean, he's always been sort of a swing on the assembly. So we've got three people who are kind of down the center of the road, it looks like, headed for the assembly, and nothing particularly changed, except it moved a little away from the left and more towards the center, in my opinion.
Okay, we want to get Dermot Cole in here pretty soon, but before we do, Paul Jenkins, Victor Don Smith in the school board race would like to make the board more conservative. How can he do that, and how long might it take?
He's not going to do that. It'll take forever, but it's going to be fun watching it. it's going to, these school board meetings should be a lot more interesting now than they have been over the past year or two. The board has become a rubber stamp, more or less, for the school, the district administration. They're going to get one negative voice in there anyway, or one nay vote, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of an effect he has, if
Final,
any.
Thank you. Final thought, Brendan. Turnout was poor. Paul alluded to it earlier. In your judgment, why?
Nothing sexy, like Paul said, but also anybody in downtown Mountain View, Fairview, Government Hill, they didn't have an assembly member to vote for. So how interested are they in the school board seats? How interested are they in the various bonds? You know, there was the two bonds that I think people were sort of interested in were the Sand Lake Fire, the Sand Lake Ambulance for the fire department, and another fire bond for a couple fire engines, and those both barely passed. But really just nothing sexy, particularly if you don't have an assembly member on the ballot.
Dermot Cole, thank you for waiting for us. Yet again, the question before us is there a gas line in your future? We just heard from ConocoPhillips and their partners, BP. They think they can build one for some $35 billion. Tell us about it.
Well, Mike, what astounds me about that figure is that it's $6 billion different than the TransCanada Exxon proposal at its uppermost. So that tells you, even among people who have looked at this pretty closely, there is a pretty big gap in what they think it's going to cost ultimately. And that's part of the problem. This is an enormous expense, and there are new challenges that are seeming to come up every month to a pipeline from Alaska to Canada. And most strikingly recently is this shale gas development in the lower 48 that has really changed the dynamics of the market. There's going to be an open season for the Denali gas pipeline this summer, just as there will be an open season for the TransCanada Exxon proposal. We won't know the results for some time, but it really will be the end product that comes out of that bidding process that will give us a clue as to what the market will say about this and whether or not it's going to go ahead.
And if I remember from the reporting correctly, the estimate would be that gas would flow somewhere around 2020, which would mean if you were interested in gas or getting a job on the gas line or having gas heat your home in 1980, you would have waited 40 years.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're getting closer and closer to the day when we may or may not have a pipeline. So that's what you can say with
that. Well, that apparently is going to be the take-home line from this show, unless Paul can top it.
No,
Paul?
I don't think I can. No, he's right. We may or may not. May 1st, we'll have the TransCanada Exxon open season, and early in July, we'll have the ConocoPhillips open season. Anybody that joins into that open season will be doing it conditionally. The open season doesn't resolve the tax and royalty issues that only the state can resolve. So that's going to have to come further down the line. And at some point, and I think everybody agrees, and I don't know why there's the delay other than AGEA, all of these people are going to have to get together. There's only going to be one pipeline. There's going to be one pipeline. Nobody's going to build two pipelines. And at some point, they're all going to join and decide who's going to do what to whom, and then they're going to go to the government and do what they can to get their favorable conditions to the government. Then we can move on. But until then, we're at the point where what he said, you know, it may or may not. You never know. But if they don't join together, it's just they're whistling in the dark.
Let's go back to Dermot Cole in Fairbanks. Dermot, state Senate leaders want to spend money, lots and lots of money on a capital budget, something like $1.3 billion was the report yesterday in state funds. What comes to mind when I hear a figure like that is the word wow. And Dermot, tell us about the fate of the UAF science building while you're telling us about that state capital budget.
Well, this, you know, state capital budget, which, by the way, is developed in secret and then is sort of launched upon the public, an unsuspecting public, I might add, is pretty substantial from the Senate view. The House may make it larger, may reduce it somewhat. What I'm struck by is the stark contrast between the rhetoric about fiscal conservatism and the rhetoric about the coming financial problems with the decline in oil production. And this proposal to spend it while we've got it you know, right now. I mean, it really shows part of the problem that we have such a short time horizon in our political system that we're just looking ahead to the next election or to the next couple of years. If we look 5-6 years out, our financial situation is not as rosy as it appears right now. About the life sciences building, that's a top priority for the University of Alaska. Remains to be seen if that's going to get it into the budget this year, which is kind of surprising considering how much else there is in the budget right now. I know that the university is trying, and its supporters from across the state are trying to get that life sciences building funded, because as we've mentioned on this show before, some of the science facilities at the Fairbanks campus are really in need of being updated. And some of our high schools have better facilities than the university does. And so that project is really a big one for this part of the state.
Thank you, Dermot. Paul, senators call this a jobs bill. Is it? And let's go back to what Dermot said about fiscal conservatism. We have people who run on this all the time, and now they're sort of being the ones who've kept up the rhetoric of conservatism being treated as party poopers.
I think what they're doing is responding to an increase in demand for this kind of money. Last year was a fairly small capital budget, so there's this pent-up demand for more money to build roads or something, whatever they're going to build with this money. I don't know what has happened to fiscal conservatism. I really don't.
Well, we heard the voice of Con Bundy, if I might. Excuse me for interrupting. There is at least one voice.
There's one, maybe two, maybe three. but Dermot Cole's right. I mean, you've got the throughput in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline is drying up at 6% a year. There's no exploration because of lousy tax policies the legislature can't address. You've got tourism is in the tank. Pebble Mine is a maybe. Fishing, who cares? And who's going to be running the state government in 6 or 7 years? It's going to be you and me. They're going to come for an income tax. At that point in time, these guys get to explain fiscal conservatism to people who are now having to reach in their pockets. And I think that, is it a jobs bill? What kind of jobs? Are they jobs that last? Are they jobs that are solid? Are they jobs created that will down the road create wealth? No, they're not.
Well, I think
they're just a job to hand out money.
Pardon me. Wouldn't they say that, you know, unemployment's the highest it's been in a number of years, we need to put people to work, and this is the way we're going to do it?
Well, the way you do that is you revamp the state tax policies, you do all these things, and you let private industry get on its feet and do its job. But this kind of spending is wonderful. It's a shot to the arm. It's like the permanent fund dividend. It's a one shot every year, boom, there's $1 billion in the economy. Then it dries up and goes away. What we need is long-term job growth. And I think Governor Parnell has a good point when he says throwing this kind of money into the economy is going to superheat the economy. We're going to far outstrip the available Alaskans to do the work. And we're talking construction jobs, engineering jobs, that kind of thing. At the end of the day, we're going to be importing people from outside to do these jobs. And how does that help Alaska exactly?
So you're comparing it to Red Bull, is that what you're
pretty
saying?
Much, yeah.
Okay. Brendan, the race for the Republican nomination for lieutenant governor takes a new turn. Sitting lieutenant governor, appointed lieutenant governor Craig Campbell drops out. Why? Tell us. And Eddie Burke enters the race. You are our resident expert on Eddie's career, so tell us what you know.
As far as Campbell goes, the speculation is that he's going to try to get the job as CEO of the Alaska Railroad, since Pat Gamble, current CEO, is going to become president of the University of Alaska. He says that when he was first talking to his wife about it, that wasn't a consideration. But that's what I had heard before he actually made the announcement. As far as Mr. Burke goes, the former conservative radio talk show host with whom I appeared for some time regularly, Eddie entered the race when he knew that Campbell was dropping out. That's what he told me. He wouldn't have run otherwise. What happened to his career as a talk show host, you get two different versions depending on whether you ask Eddie or you ask station management, but it was basically a mutually acceptable splitting of Eddie with KBYR. Eddie didn't necessarily like the way things were going there. They weren't exactly happy with his ratings. The Glenn Beck program had moved opposite him on another station, which sort of split the Tea Party audience. So the ratings weren't what they could have been. And so Eddie is now running for lieutenant governor. And I think part of his motivation is him and Lieutenant, or him and Representative Jay Ramirez don't get along particularly well, and Eddie always had a good time razzing Representative Ramirez on the air. Now we get to watch it in the Lieutenant Governor debates, and as we were talking about earlier, this should be one of the most fun Lieutenant Governor races, primaries to watch. Don't know that people pay much attention ordinarily, but this will be some good entertainment value.
Now, do we know if he's going to go back to work as on the radio, Eddie, or is he going to go out and campaign or sell real estate or the different things he's done in the past?
I think he's just focusing on the Lieutenant Governor thing for now, and who knows what happens after that, assuming that, I mean, Jay Ramirez has one of the biggest banks of any statewide candidate for any office. He's going to be tough to beat, almost a shoo-in, I would say, just looking at the numbers. So what Eddie does afterwards, who knows? Eddie likes to be involved in the political process.
This is where he can say a choice, not an echo.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
Yes.
A state judge says fix rural schools. We've heard this before. And the judge says, I'm paying attention. I want you to act fairly quickly, state of Alaska. This ruling is of consequence because the lawsuits that have spurned the driven the judge to make this kind of ruling have gone on for quite a while. Tell us about the suits and what this could mean for rural districts.
Well, Michael, there have been two major lawsuits about rural education and its deficiencies over the years. This latest one deals with the poor performance of some rural districts. Part of what this shows is the gap between small rural areas and the performance of students in urban areas, and part of it shows what's really a dysfunctional local government situation. By not having local governments by having REAAs instead, there's really the lack of local control and accountability, and that's part of what's going on here. There's also cultural issues. This is a very complicated matter, and the state has yet really to tackle the challenge of improving school performance in rural areas and what the causes are and what to do about it. There's a lot of those things that we're not facing.
Dermot, I talked to one of the lawyers who's involved, and he assured me that, of course, he's a reasonable man looking for a reasonable solution, but that this is not going to go away, and the requirement that rural students should have opportunities to advance themselves, students should have opportunities to become fully educated is something that cannot be ignored because the court's already put down some benchmarks.
Right. That's true. But I think they need to have some innovative solutions here. You're dealing with schools that have very low student populations, very few teachers, and it's hard for the teachers to cover all the topics at once. The state really needs to do more on, electronic delivery of education materials, distance delivery for courses and that sort of thing. The school districts really have to do more in that regard. And maybe the state, the legislature has to take a more direct role in this. I mean, the REAAs don't really have a financial stake in this, so their power is somewhat limited. I'd say this is part of the problem of not having any local tax support for many of these districts. Now, granted, there's not much in the way of property taxes you could get from a lot of them, but I don't know, our whole system isn't working very well.
Okay, thank you, Dermot. Paul, has the legislature been avoiding this these lawsuits and their potential consequences as they've gone through the process?
I don't know if you could characterize it as avoiding. This suit was filed in 2004. It's Moore v. Alaska.
Right.
And basically it's gone to several different areas. It's been in and out of court. Judge Sharon Gleason most recently said, well, really, the Department of Education has fulfilled its constitutional obligation to provide an education, but the problem is that they don't teach these kids enough in the small rural areas to pass the exit exam, and she sees that as patently unfair and unconstitutional. So she's given them 2 months. They give 2 months, straighten this out. And she's given them time before. She's given them a year at one point, 2 years at another point, to get things in order. Yeah. And so now she said 2 months, straighten it out, or I'm going to appoint a master, which courts did in 1981 with the Department of Corrections when they took that over.
And this is something legislatures don't like, and to some degree the lawyers are not crazy about either, because you don't know what the master's apt to do.
You don't know. He could just take it over and run it. The thing with the crux of this thing is, to me, and I'm not an expert in it, the Department of Education in this state has a hands-off policy. It does not really get down and do the nitty-gritty with the small rural districts. They let school districts run their own districts and try to do a hands-off thing. Well, that may work for a larger district that has adequate funding or adequate teachers, adequate supervisory and administrative personnel. But some small school district with a very tiny number of students in school has got a real problem. And so the state, I think, has been remiss in not helping them, assisting them. And the judge thinks the same thing. So she's given them 2 months.
And the judge also wasn't happy with teacher training and retention.
Any of that,
so
that's correct. That whole area is
Brendan, you had a story exploring the debate over parental notification for minors who want to obtain an abortion. We are probably going to see this question on the ballot soon, but before we see it on the ballot, we're going to see it in court.
Yeah,
tell us about your story.
It has been in the courts. It actually stretches back. In 1997, the legislature passed the Parental Consent Act, requiring parental consent for abortions for minors. That went immediately to the courts and was tied up for 10 years until 2007, when they knocked it down, said it violated Article 1, Section 22, the Privacy Clause of the state constitution. But the judge, I believe it was Justice Dana Fabe, wrote, perhaps a less restrictive way would be notification. So upon that, immediately, the Alaska Family Council, Jim Minery, who's all over abortion issues, amongst other things, formed a group, Alaskans for Parental Rights. They submitted a petition to the Lieutenant Governor saying this is the initiative we want to have for parental notification. At the time, it was now Governor Sean Parnell was Lieutenant Governor. He certified it. They got these petitions, which have a summary of what the initiative is, and started gathering signatures in districts across the state. At the same time, Planned Parenthood and the ACLU of Alaska sued to stop this. They did get enough signatures to get it on the ballot. They got significantly more signatures than they needed to get this initiative on the ballot. But a couple weeks ago, Judge Fifner decided in Superior Court that two of the three claims Planned Parenthood and the ACLU had against the initiative were upheld. One being that the most important one being that the summary, which is what was on the petition and what would be on the ballot, is not impartial and accurate, which is a requirement of it. The other part had to do with prescriptions for how fast the court had to address things. You cannot, by initiative, prescribe court rules. It's against the Constitution. So they struck that language, the court language, from the initiative, said that's fine, and said change the summary and this can go on to the ballot. Monday of this week, Planned Parenthood and the ACLU filed an appeal saying, you can't just change it for the ballot because this language that you said was not impartial and accurate was on the petitions that were being signed. So people were signing something that they didn't fully understand. Of course, Mr. Minery and the Alaska Family Council and Alaskans for Parental Rights disagree. And then the day afterwards, the State Department of Law filed a cross appeal saying, no, the state superior court's wrong. The summary was just fine because the Department of Law's job
is... You make me feel like I'm going to have a law degree to read the news story.
You know, I practically needed one to write the story. Anyway, they're on an accelerated schedule with the Alaska Supreme Court because the ballots have to be printed at the beginning of June. They're filing their briefs between now and May 20th, which is the next day. The Supreme Court scheduled to hear oral arguments. It could be that day, could be later, but the Supreme Court will then decide if this parental notification initiative will be on your August 24th primary ballot.
Thank you very much for that summary. Dermot, the Tanana Chiefs Conference comes out for a road to Nome. This surprised many people, including myself. Why is the TCC now in favor of a road to Nome, and where would this road go, and how much would it cost?
Well, Mike, it was kind of a surprising change in policy for the Tanana Chiefs Conference, but I'm not really sure that it means all that much. The road would go from Manly Hot Springs west to Nome, and that sounds fine until you look at the cost, which might be $2 billion to $3 billion or more. And it's really the cost that's going to doom this project. I don't see this happening because there's just no way they can, lawmakers are not going to approve this spending.
Well, that would be something like 2 to 3 times the capital budget as a whole just for 1 year, right?
Right, and people in Fairbanks could make a great case why this should be the only item in the capital budget, don't you think? No, I don't think so.
I'm sure they could.
But I do think one of these days, maybe Paul Jenkins will be able to ride his motorcycle from Fairbanks or from Anchorage to Nome.
Bless your heart.
And we're looking forward to that. We're running out of time here, but Brendan, I wanted to come back to you. Some people who are not fans of Mark Begich think that he should be recalled and taken out of office, and that the U.S. senators and congressmen should be recalled when they don't vote the right way. This was developed after this idea came popular with some people after the health care vote. What do you make of this?
The short answer is no. There's no precedent for a member of Congress being subject to a recall. The U.S. Constitution doesn't provide for it. But some people will argue there are 17 states, Alaska being one of them, that don't say that you can't. The Alaska Constitution and our statutes say you can recall members of the state government, and they list some, but they don't include senators or congressmen. But they don't specify that you can't either. But it's never happened before. Some people are trying to do it to Senator Menendez in New Jersey, and we're out of time.
Thank you very much. And he is correct. We are out of time. We'll see you next week right here on Anchorage Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.